Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Hope everyone had a restful and enjoyable Thanksgiving Day weekend.
Yeah, what did you end up doing, Dan?
Stuff. And yourself, did you watch sports or did you go the route of John Cass and just watch soccer? What did you do?
We watched the England-USA game. That was so boring. Oh, 0-0. Nil-nil, as they say. No, but I actually watched the Lincoln Way East Loyola Ramblers high school class 8A championship game.
Another state championship for John Holasek.
Yeah, yep. It was good. But actually, I spent the whole week at Northridge Prep.
Interesting note on that.
Yes.
Six
oh, yes.
of the eight state champions.
Yeah.
Six of the eight classes, you know, 1A to 8A, Catholic schools.
Okay, there you go. That's right. Well, but that Lincoln Way East, that quarterback number 15, that little guy, he was so fun to watch. I mean, anytime he couldn't pass the ball, he just ran, and he was fearless. So
yeah, it was great. It was really impressive.
The 3 points
down
the game?
They put up. Yeah, 13-3 was 13, the score.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah. It was great. The kicker.
John Holasek is the best football coach in the state of Illinois.
I know, and they look like they're playing, you know, the Iowa team with those linemen there. But also, I was at Northridge Prep all week because they have their annual basketball tournament. And everywhere I turned, oh, hi, Amy. Where's Dan? Is Dan coming? Well, your son's going to play. Isn't Dan going to be here? And it was a great crew. Have you met Will
Dan's
Ray?
Not here.
Dan's not here. Is Dan coming? Like, finally, after 5 days of at the tournament, I said, listen, Dan is not coming.
He
so you're
going to
have to deal with me, okay?
Dan, just tell him Dan is a figment of my imagination. He doesn't really exist.
I kept saying, well, he's in the bathroom. He'll be here, you know, at halftime. But, yeah, we won the tournament this year. Amundsen High School. Last year we came in last place, and this year we beat Northridge Prep. We beat Wheeling High School by 22 points. It was very impressive. And then Northridge, which is very well coached by Will Ray as their head coach. Wonderful man. He teaches them the fundamentals. They're a great team, but they're a young team.
Yeah, so college, I mean, Coach Loyola.
Yeah, and we still beat them by it was 12 points. So it was pretty impressive for us.
Thanks for that high school sports beat
well,
wrap-up
deal.
That's
Thank how you. I spent my Thanksgiving watching high school basketball.
I was fixated on the Macy's Day Parade, of course.
Oh, of course.
If I can't participate in a parade, the next best thing is to be able to watch it. And so I did, and there was a delightful moment. It's just so much fun. It's so real, and the reviewers, I guess you call them reporters.
Yes.
They're so genuine. They're so full of personality.
Yeah.
It just brings the whole holiday to light. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. This is NBC reporter, reviewer
Ooh,
on the parade beat, Dylan Dreyer.
So she does the weather, but Al Roker, who's never missed a Macy's Day Parade, got a blood clot, so she had to fill in at the last minute. I'm not kidding.
A blood clot is a punchline for you, apparently.
I know. I don't know why I'm laughing. I shouldn't laugh.
Yeah, I was barraged by the wall-to-wall Al Roker coverage from the tabloids as well. I did notice that. But Dylan Dreyer, you know, she's reporting on all of the entrants as they're making their way past her, and it's, again, vivid. It's like I was there. That's the quality of the review. But then she gets a call out of nowhere.
I think I'm getting a phone call. You know, I'm not one to take a phone call during TV. Oh, but I think I should answer this one. Hello, Mr. President?
What?
Oh, there's a...
I don't think I can hear you. Can you hear me, Mr. President?
trying to work that contraption.
Yeah.
Is that Joe?
You got the phone upside down.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, there you are.
We're here.
Oh,
happy Thanksgiving.
I was so worried this call wasn't going to go through. How are you?
We're fine. We're fine. You're watching your parade. You're doing a good job.
Oh, thank you.
That's the magic of the holiday for me.
Oh, gross.
Totally unscripted. The president just happens to catch Dylan Dreyer while she's on the air reporting on the parade. What a wonderful, organic moment I was able to experience.
So natural.
It was very natural.
First of all,
they didn't even know they called her. That's how spontaneous it was.
And he can't even call somebody without Jill by his side. What do they have? Two lines? Honey, now talk now. Talk now.
Yeah, that infernal contraption, the mobile phone. So Thanksgiving also, though, it's time for family and fellowship.
Right.
That spills over, though, when you're watching some of these events. So I saw there was a fight in the stands at the soccer match between Argentina and Mexico.
Yeah, well, there was also a fight in a bar in Chicago, too.
Well, yeah. The fight in the bar in Chicago was, as you would expect, more violent than actually in the stands in the arena. And by the way, is there anything more hysterical than people getting into a fight over which country has the best soccer team? This is on Division. Three cops were injured in this fight trying to break it up. And it was involved men and women, 15 people outside this bar on West Division at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
The mugshots.
My country's better than
great.
Yours. Oh, yeah. Did you see those mugshots, Dan?
Yeah. As I tweeted over the weekend, arguing about which country has the best soccer team is like arguing about which Kardashian is the most chaste. Sort of, you're missing the larger point.
Right.
Another related story, too. I like these, family gatherings around Thanksgiving or with friends where you can beat on each other watching a soccer match at a bar on Division. This out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And by the way, have you watched the new series with Sylvester Stallone, speaking of Tulsa, Tulsa King?
I haven't yet, but I watched about a half of an episode.
It's only a few episodes in. Taylor Sheridan is the showrunner, the same guy who did
and
does Yellowstone.
And they promote the heck out of it if you're watching Yellowstone.
Well, right, yeah. Trying to get the residual viewership.
Did you watch it?
Yeah, I've watched the first couple episodes. I'm open-minded. It hasn't won me over, but I'm open-minded. It has its moments. Anyway, in real life, Tulsa, officers called about 6:30 p.m. on Thanksgiving. They had to take John Armstrong into custody because he opened fire on his stepfather and his stepfather's daughter. It started when a fight broke out while they were playing a game of Monopoly.
Monopoly?
Monopoly. After turning the board over and turning the furniture over, the two guys that got in a fight were told to take the disagreement outside, which they did, and then stepson pulled out a gun after getting cut in the head with flying figures, I guess, from the Monopoly game. I don't know. Get paper cut from one of the cards. Chased his stepfather and stepsister down the street, pointing the gun, and he fired a shot. He was taken into custody and booked on assault with a deadly weapon.
Family time, yeah.
I do. It probably, I'm not paying that rent at Park Place. And then it just escalated from there, is what I envision. But, board games can get intense.
Oh, my God. What's intense is we played family football, and I got leveled by my nephew, who's 6'5", 220 pounds.
Oh, really? Full tackle?
Full tackle. He was running a route, I was running a route, and we smashed. And all I remember, I saw stars as I flew through the air and then rolled. But I had to thank God for Northridge Prep because their trainer, Michael McCormick, it worked on me the last 2 days. I came early to the games, and he helped me out with my knee and with my neck. It's pretty serious. Oh. And he said there's so many people that have football injuries right now from playing family football.
Well, right, because you're old people and you think you're not old people. And then it doesn't even need to be tackling. I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure nobody was like tackling, form tackling you.
Well, it was supposed to be touch, but there was a lot of tackling. And then my nephew.
There's a lot of falling is what there was.
One of my nephews brought his cleats. So we're at Kirkwood High School on the turf, sure. And he has cleats. So, I mean, we're all slipping and sliding because it rained. Not fair. I'm like, next year we'll bring pads.
Well, that's the point, is it's like the Monopoly game. Are we playing a serious game of Monopoly or not? Are we playing a serious game of football or not? You don't want to wear cleats? Don't wear cleats. I'm wearing cleats because I'm here to win.
That's what he did. Yeah. Just and like, their team won, too, because cleats guy caught every pass.
You don't want to bring a gun to a Monopoly game? Don't bring the gun. I'm bringing a gun because I'm here to win. Same deal. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, before Thanksgiving, President Trump had a meeting at Mar-a-Lago with Kanye West, Yee, as he's known to, I don't know who exactly.
The younger generation.
Formerly Adidas, I know that, but not anymore.
Oh, too soon, Dan.
Yeah.
The man has lost billions of dollars.
So Kanye and this guy, Nick Fuentes.
Never heard of him.
That's what Trump said.
Who's heard of Nick Fuentes? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. You can always reach us, too, on our text line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
We're led to believe this was about Kanye's announcement that he's going to run for president in 2024, and two erstwhile contenders for the presidency in 2024 hashing things out among friends. Yeah. There was a report in Mediaite that Kanye asked Trump to be his running mate.
Yeah, that's what he claims. Uh-huh. There's audio of him saying that, too.
Here's Kanye's debriefing with Milo Yiannopoulos in tow of the meeting.
I think the thing that Trump was most perturbed about, me asking him to be my vice president, I think that was like lower on the list of things that caught him off guard. It was the fact that I walked in with intelligence. So Trump is really impressed with Nick Fuentes. And Nick Fuentes, unlike so many of the lawyers and so many people that he was left with on his 2020 campaign, he's actually a loyalist. When he didn't know what the lawyers is, you'll still have your lawyer list. And when all the lawyers said, forget it, Trump's done, there are loyalists running up in the White House, right? And my question would be, why, when you had the chance, did you not free the January Sixers? And I came to him as someone who loves Trump, and I said, go and get Corey back. Go and get these people that the media tried to cancel and told you to step away from. He basically gives me this would-be mob-esque kind of story. Talking to some kid from the south side of Chicago trying to sound mobby or whatever. He goes into the story about all that he went through to get Alice Johnson out of jail and how he didn't do it for Kim, but he did it for me. But then he goes on to say that Kim is a and you could tell her I said that. And I was thinking, like, that's the mother of my children. Since we know, and all the Christians in America that love Trump know that Trump is a conservative, we're going to demand that you hold all policies directly to the Bible. When Trump started basically screaming at me at the table, telling me I was going to lose, I mean, has that ever worked for anyone in history?
You're going to lose. Tell him he's going to lose.
I'm like, well, hold on, Trump. You're talking to Ye.
Perfect.
Is it Ye or Ye?
I thought it was Ye.
It's Yeezy is the shoe. Yeah. Right. Yay!
Oh, and by the way, Goodwill's not selling easy shoes in protest of Kanye West.
Like, powerful statement.
Goodwill gets involved, please.
You know, that kid from the South Side, Kanye, he may be returning to the South Side sooner than he had planned at this rate. The whole thing is bizarre. What do you make of it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. It's just the circus that loves, the bread and circuses, if you will, that the public so loves because it's so easy to heap moral scorn. It gets everybody riled up and talking about Trump. And I think Kanye is somewhat similarly situated. I don't know why he would otherwise be hanging out and extolling the virtues of a racist goofball like Nick Fuentes, other than for the spectacle of it all.
Right. He can't get an audience with anybody. So Nick Fuentes, he can get an audience with him. Trump mistakenly let him in his house the night before Thanksgiving for dinner.
Whoa. He doesn't need an audience with Nick Fuentes. The question is this spectacle for spectacle's sake? Mistakenly let him in the house? Wait, it was an accident? No, it wasn't an accident. It was a poor judgment? Maybe it was poor judgment. Or maybe it was something Trump wanted to do and Kanye wanted to do. These are sort of master manipulators of public opinion, are they not? Is that not what the evidence shows? They're both billionaires in part because they're master manipulators of the press and they're master deliverers of the bread and circuses that so much of the American public loves to consume. I mean, do you see this as a deranged Kanye and deranged Trump, and these are, you know, two people that deserve each other? They should run as a ticket because they both have terrible judgment. Or do they have an insight into the body politic that doesn't follow politics, but a large percentage of whom do vote? And they want to be entertained. They want spectacle, just like they get every night on television.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I never heard of this Nick Fuentes person.
You know where Nick Fuentes went to high school?
I don't know. Where?
Lyons Township.
Really?
I think he was class president at Lyons Township High School.
Wow.
Who
is he? An influencer? I'm sorry.
No, he's not an influencer. He's he's like a white supremacist. Really? I mean, he said all kinds. I mean, I haven't followed him very much because why waste your time with people like this? And the people that the DC press corps obsesses about are marginal characters at best. So I don't feel the need to spend the limited time I have on such unproductive ventures and getting into the weeds and Nick Fuentes. I've seen enough of what he said to know what he's about. And I don't know if he's truly a virulent racist or if he's just a provocateur a la Milo Yiannopoulos and just trying to make a spectacle of himself to get attention and maybe to make some money, build enough of an audience to make money on social media or what. I don't know. I don't know what his motivations are. I don't much care.
Well, he's a Holocaust denier.
Right. He's a stupid racist goofball, is what I said. He's a goof. He says ridiculous things. And Kanye says a lot of ridiculous things. And from time to time, Trump says a lot of ridiculous things. They're not on the order of what Nick Fuentes says. But, you know, I think of Kanye's return to Twitter. Did you see what Kanye tweeted when he was allowed back on Twitter?
No, what'd he do?
Shalom.
Oh.
that to me just screams
instigator.
That does not scream, you know, ideological anti-Semite. It's anti-Semite. It screams instigator. It screams, look at me. And so, you know, you'll pardon me if I don't take the bait and join the chorus of the button-down Wall Street Journal Ed Board types with this hand-wringing over this meeting. you know, and the political establishment, jumped the shark, and this is disturbing, and so on and so forth. I know what Nick Fuentes is, and I know he's not to be taken seriously. I know he is to be dismissed as somebody who is not important, who doesn't have important ideas, who is, I don't know. Again, I don't know if this is an act or if he's a racist. The things he says are abhorrent and racist and ignorant. He's a clown.
He was president of student council, by the way.
And Kanye says a lot of things that are buffoonish, too. And he makes a spectacle of himself, like when he went to the White House with Jim Brown. And he and Jim Brown had that, you know, across the desk in the Oval Office meeting with Trump. And Kanye, you know, Jim Brown was even keel, and Kanye was, you know, making a spectacle of himself. Being cogent sometimes and saying things that were difficult to decipher other times. So, you know, I don't like getting played, and I feel like that this is a play on the public here. But that's just me. That's just my intuition. And so, I mean, yes, on the Nick Fuentes stuff and on much of what some of what Kanye said, too. But although I'll tell you, you know, the whole Adidas thing, because there's a big piece in the Wall Street Journal of the weekend about how Adidas executives worry that Kanye was a ticking time bomb. He could melt down at any time, and what to do about him. And maybe they should disassociate from him and sever their relationship prior to what occurred and so on and so forth. But then, well, Yeezy products are 8% of our gross sales. So I don't, we're making too much money to cut ties. So I don't know what all this back and forth. And as Chappelle mentioned this actually in his monologue on Saturday Night Live a couple weeks ago,
that's brilliant.
He alluded to it. You know, Adidas, you know what Adidas stands for? You know where the name originates?
I don't. What is it?
Adidas. Adolf Dassler. The Dassler brothers, who founded Adidas in Germany, were members of the Nazi Party. Fact. And so, you know, all this moralizing, given the foundings of Adidas, is sort of rich when it comes to Kanye. Living in a bit of a glass shoe house or a glass shoe box, aren't we? David and Winneka, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. So, got so much to say here. There's so many different angles, but I think that would be a genius play. Trump and Kanye running together. You know, first and foremost, dispels all the racism thing about, you know, Trump and this and that. That's the first thing. And then if you think about it,
I don't know that it does anything of the sort, given Kanye's troubles. But okay.
And
if he ran with Tim Scott, if he ran with Clarence Thomas, does that end the calls that Trump is a racist, he's a white nationalist, he's a white supremacist? No, it does not.
Yeah, probably not. But put it this way: of all the circus and craziness that we got going on right now, the debate could be, you know, Kanye and Trump on one team, Kamala and Sleepy on the other, and they could just do like a round of Jeopardy. And I guarantee you, Kanye and Trump, boom.
Celebrity Jeopardy to decide the presidency. With this crew, I don't know if Jeopardy may be a little bit of a reach. It's more like Celebrity Password, I think, maybe.
I don't know.
I'm just saying. You know, but as much as, you know, this stuff, you know, annoys me because you feel compelled to talk about it because it's what everybody's talking about. That doesn't mean there's still not an underlying thing with respect to Trump. And I got to say, I was interested in this piece that a former Northwestern law professor, he's emeritus now, Stephen Presser, wrote about Trump. And he sort of says some of the things I said about last week, particularly with respect to Trump's legal problems. He writes, Professor Stephen Presser, again, Professor Emeritus of Legal History at Northwestern's Pritzker School of Law. Those who say that Trump's time has passed and that his ability through unrestrained and boorish behavior to alienate Americans such as single women and suburban voters renders him unelectable. And it remains true that powerful forces in the media, academy, and in many of the state governments are arrayed against him. Nevertheless, Trump does learn from his mistakes, and his lately more subdued tone, this must have been written before the meeting at Mar-a-Lago,
yeah.
His real record of accomplishment and his innate political talent still make him the most formidable Republican contender. His ongoing persecution by corrupt state and federal officials can actually be turned into a powerful endorsement through carefully crafted anti-corruption messaging. He will have to convince his fellow Republicans through the primary campaign, but he's done it before, and he still represents the best chance we have to reclaim a government committed to the restoration of the rule of law and the sovereignty of the American people. You know, the whole sort of Batman, not the hero you want, the hero you need sort of argument, warts and all. But Presser's point is that Trump is the only candidate, and I think DeSantis has done some of this, so I think he deserves more credit than he's given in this column, but the only candidate who's called out the bipartisan corruption endemic to the Beltway. And that is a powerful populist force that he still enjoys. It shouldn't be dismissed. Put it another way. This was from a couple of months ago, but this is such a good riff. We mentioned Chappelle. Here's another comedian.
Who?
His name is Andrew Schultz. Listen to his and think about this, too, in the context of this meeting at Mar-a-Lago with two master marketers in Kanye and Trump. Andrew Schultz on the MAGA hat.
Joe Biden. No. Biden ain't got no merch. Like, that's how I judge presidents now, bro. Can you move merch or can you not? Does Trump have merch, bro? That MAGA hat was iconic. Bro, that was white people's teardrop tattoo. That's what that was. You saw a white dude with the hat, you were like, yeah! He don't give a f***! In public, dog! In public, the hat is the last thing you put on your body before you leave the house. It's so easy not to wear it. But some people look at that hat like, how difficult do I want my day to be? Fuck it, I choose violence today.
I love the MAGA hat is the white people's teardrop tattoo.
Perfect.
That's good. That's a good line. But move merch.
Move merch.
Can you move merch? Can you move merchandise? It's. I mean, you know, political campaigns are exercises in marketing.
Uh-huh.
Just think about it. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So today's the day, the last day to file to run for mayor of the city of Chicago. So, Amy, people want to know, what's it going to be? You in or out?
Well, we better start collecting petition or signatures right now.
5 o'clock.
I have till 5 o'clock today?
Yeah.
We could do it. Remember when we trained for the marathon in a day? We did the long run in the morning, then took a break, and then did the short run. So
why not?
And you need what? How many? 12,500? How many signatures do I need?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, no, I will not be running for mayor because...
That's disappointing.
I'm sorry, because I thought you were going to run for mayor.
I'm not a Chicago resident. I'm not even allowed to talk about the mayor's race. I'm not allowed to talk about the city of Chicago.
Oh, that's or the state of Illinois.
Because I'm not a resident. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
You know, it reminds me because you can't talk about abortion either because you don't have a vagina. You know, it's the same
not
argument.
Not yet, I don't.
You just wait, sister.
Yeah.
You don't know this Christmas surprise I got going on down under.
I can fix that real quick. How'd that serve you, huh?
It's the same argument, though, and it makes me laugh when people say that. Well, who cares what Dan says? He doesn't live here.
Okay. Do you care what people who do live there say when they say the same things I do? Or did you care what I said for the first 50 years of my life when I did live there?
I know.
No. So it's not the physical, it's not my physical location that's the issue, is it? And this is the point, isn't it? The point is, we were talking, I mean, this is sort of a corollary to our conversation before the news at the top of the hour about the Trump-Kanye-Nick Fuentes meeting. Can we just be serious and understand that a majority of people in places like Chicago and in big cities around America and in some states in their entirety, they are not serious people. And they're not looking for serious people. They're looking for spectacle.
Yep.
This is why they find it kitschy and fun if you have a pansexual dwarf lecturing you about public safety. Or you have a morbidly obese trust fund baby lecturing you about personal health.
Yeah.
They love it.
Well, the spectacle is going to continue this morning because remember, Mayor Lightfoot, she said she's going to turn in her petitions on the last day. She may need a wheelbarrow or a front loader.
No.
We want her to come in with Census Cowboy and hit bring in her ballot.
So when you come on November 28th and you see the wheelbarrow or the hand truck that we pull in with all of our petitions, I think that will answer your question.
Answer what? You got a lot of signatures? Big deal. Yeah. Any Yahoo can do that. I mean, Spanky the Clown could do that. Big deal. But the spectacle piece, yeah, Census Cowboy playing dress up. She should file as a Rona Buster with Allison Irwadi, the Wonder Twins. Do the whole thing because that's TikTok. What people care about. Let me give you an example of this. This is Sam Sanchez, who is the chairman of the Illinois Restaurant Association.
Oh, yes.
And he's the principal in the Third Coast Hospitality Group, which has restaurants in town like Moe's Cantina and La Luna. Here's what he posted to Twitter, or to Instagram, I mean. I'm watching Flannery on Fire on Sunday morning. Saw many mayoral candidates talk about crime. I haven't heard a solution. If you understand how the judicial system works, you would know who is responsible for most of the crime that's happening in our city and in Cook County. Cook County State's Attorney. Approves all charges, and after the police makes the arrest, has full discretion on who to charge or not to charge with a crime, and should prosecute, but short 235 prosecutors now. Cook County Chief Justice sets the rules and standard of the judicial system on who to release or hold without bail. The judges have the power over a mayor or a prosecutor. That's Sam Sanchez, the chairman of the Illinois Restaurant Association, running interference for triple threat. She doesn't have anything to do with crime. And to the extent she does, he tweeted screenshots of November of this year versus November of last year from HeyJackass.com with the number of shot and killed and shot and wounded. And, you know, we're down a little bit. In November, we only had 16 homicides as compared to 52 last November. So that's supposed to be cause for celebration. Or that's supposed to be indicative of some long-term trend.
Go lesbians.
Go lesbians.
Because she tweeted that out, yes.
That should be on her yard signs.
Right.
Go lesbians. It will be on the yard signs that I make up for her, for sure. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Can we just be serious? I mean, just be honest that we're not serious.
Right, because there's going to be a spectacle today. You know it when she turns in her petition.
Forget today. Talking about the entire thing.
Every day, the whole thing. Doing TikToks, the entire thing. Karaoke contests, everything's a distraction and a joke. Everything she has done is not serious.
No. We're not serious.
Oh, it's our problem. Okay.
We don't want serious. We don't want problem solved. Sam Sanchez, where's your plan? That is the pseudo intellectual bon mot. Where's your plan? Where's your plan? Where's your plan to combat crime? Uh-huh. That's what's lacking, Sam. Nobody has a plan to combat crime. And to the extent you listen to these other mayoral candidates, I mean, Cam Buckner, who is the sponsor of the Safety Act,
right,
calls Lightfoot's tenure a pandemic of violence. This is a guy who wants to defund the police, and de-prosecute criminals, and decarcerate the convicted.
Yeah.
And he is do the pandemic of violence two-step.
Oh, please. What a hypocrite.
Nobody cares. We're not looking for serious people. We're looking to be entertained. And the more nonsensical, the more laughable are the positions taken by people who said one thing and are now saying 180 degrees the other thing, the better. The last thing we want is some boring green eye shades guy talking about bond ratings or unfunded pension liabilities or putting together a 10-point plan to combat violent crime. Yawn. We don't want it.
But that's what we need.
No.
That's what I need. If you're sensical and logical, that's what we need.
That's
nobody
not
cares.
They're not enough sensible people left. Just the sensible people just won't confront it, but there are not enough sensible people left. Where's your plan to combat violence? Oh, gosh, I don't know, Sam Sanchez. Businessman. Businessman of, you know, a big going concern, a big restaurant group.
And he just
Chairman of the
over.
Illinois Restaurant
yeah,
Association.
Yeah, but he rolled over during COVID. He let, you know, thank you, can I have another when it came to COVID restrictions.
I know.
He never fought back
because they
for
are
himself
all,
or for his fellow man and woman in the
Because
restaurant
they are all race. Sentinels of the state. And they see the people don't want anything serious, so they go along with it because what do I care? I mean, maybe a little bit more dicey operating a business in Chicago for my employees and patrons, but what do I care? It works. It works for me. It still goes. I still make money. It's fine. And I mean, and you know, I'll participate in the mass delusion. Why not? Cherry picking a 1 month and extrapolating some larger meaning behind it in terms of where violent crime is. Also, we're down 235 prosecutors, but he doesn't say anything about being down 2,000 police and the inability to get police recruits to go to the academy to backfill those open positions. I mean, because it doesn't matter. It's just can't. It's just throwing out stuff. It doesn't need to hold up logically. There doesn't need to be any sort of consistency through that's thread through the information that he posts or anybody else. It's just, you know, it's just Instagram talk. It's just cocktail chatter. Don't you get it? Which is why the whole Paul Vallis thing. I mean, Paul Vallis could, you know, ride around Inglewood on a unicycle in a leotard and nobody pay attention. Because he's a bore. He's got a 10-point plan to reduce violence. And he wants to talk about school choice and improving educational opportunities for minority, particularly minority kids in the city, since that's 85% of the student body population in CPS. Well, that's not interesting. That's too serious.
Well, I'll never forget the first time he ran and one of my former friends was like, nope, get on the train. Get on the Lori Lightfoot train. Paul Vallis is the past. Lori Lightfoot, she's gay. She's black. She's a female. She's it.
Exactly.
Like, well, what credentials does she have?
But if Paul Vallis identified as a ficus plant or something like that, maybe he'd have a chance.
Right. Or non-binary or... age, genders. I mean, I don't know. I think boring might be good, but that's what the city needs, somebody smart like him. But I don't know if this place will embrace it. I just don't think that they will.
You know, I hate to break this news to Sam Sanchez.
Yeah.
CWB, let me introduce you to number 50.
Oh, no.
Twice convicted gun offender, shot a random driver while on bail for a felony. Prosecutors say a man who was on bail for selling nearly $3,500 worth of cocaine to an undercover cop shot a motorist who was driving to work near his home November 3rd. He is the 50th person this year accused of killing or shooting or attempting to kill or shoot someone in Chicago while awaiting trial for a felony. Those crimes have resulted in 88 victims and 22 dead. I don't know how to break this to Sam Sanchez. Let me introduce you to number 51.
Oh, no.
Chicago drug dealer free on felony bail beat a customer to death in a vacant lot for paying him with fake money, prosecutors say. On the northwest corner of Chicago and Ridgeway Avenues in Humboldt Park, it's a vacant lot. Chicago Police Department surveillance camera hangs from a light pole next to a small hand-painted billboard that declares the corner a safety zone. Ironic. In the vacant lot around 5:40 p.m. on November 9th, must have been celebrating Pritzker's re-election. This guy used a brick or rock to beat 52-year-old Michael Foley to death because Foley gave him fake money in a drug deal. But wait a second. It's a safety zone that says no gambling, drugs, or guns allowed. No gambling allowed? Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. That's the state's province. He was on bail for allegedly possessing a stolen motor vehicle. He is the 51st person accused of killing or shooting or trying to kill or shoot someone in Chicago while awaiting felony trial, while awaiting trial for a felony. This year, that would be 89 victims now, 23 dead just this year, all preventable crimes. I hate to break this news to Sam Sanchez and the other deep thinkers in the business community. Caretaker on electronic monitoring for shooting and gun cases sexually assaulted a woman with developmental disabilities. Prosecutors say a woman with the cognitive abilities of a six-year-old was sexually assaulted twice by a residential care facility worker who was on electronic monitoring for allegedly possessing a firearm while he was on bail for shooting a guy.
How did he even have that
job? Yeah, he was. So, I mean, this is a sexual assault. It's not a shooting or murdering somebody while on electronic monitoring waiting for trial on felony charges. But I don't know, sexually assaulting a woman with developmental disabilities seems like a crime that would normally shock the conscience, but we don't. We just turn our eyes away and say, that's terrible. But what does Kim, what does Lori Lightfoot have to do with that, says Sam Sanchez? Nothing. Nothing. Despite the fact that she's been an antagonist to police and a de facto defund the police advocate, her protestations protestations to the contrary otherwise, since before she was mayor, when she was on that, you know, Star Chamber reform the police board, she reinstitutes a consent decree on the Chicago police, even after it's rescinded by the Trump Department of Justice. And I don't know, Sam Sanchez and those restaurateurs, you would think they'd have a pretty good relationship with police. You'd think they'd want a pretty good relationship with police. Maybe they, Sam Sanchez in particular, should talk to some police to tell you, to tell him, as they've told us, what Lori Lightfoot has meant to the morale of the police department, what she's meant in terms of the personnel decisions that she's made, the leadership of the police department, and how that has impacted morale and the ability of police to do their job. How many of the public pronouncements that she's made that essentially indict police officers well before we know all the facts, yep, particularly in police-involved shootings that we've gone over the years.
And with the Colorado shooter, what she tweeted out, like, this blank has got to stop now. What about what's been going on in your town?
She doesn't have anything to do with it. She doesn't have anything to do with it.
That's a light weekend for us, what happened
in Colorado. Sam Sanchez, you're not listening.
Yeah.
She doesn't have anything to do with it.
Okay.
It's the prosecutor and the chief judge.
Okay.
So if you're thinking about voting on violent crime when you vote for mayor, if you're thinking that's the issue that's going to motivate you come February and April, well, you better not. The mayor doesn't have anything to do with violent crime. That's what Sam Sanchez and the business community say. And if you say anything other than Sam Sanchez says, like Chris Kibczynski did, the CEO of McDonald's, then you get chastised by Lightfoot as
racist,
not knowing what you're talking about. He should get his facts straight before he opens his pie hole. And that quiets the other otherwise cowardly business elites in the city, doesn't it? I mean, it was a mild statement, but it represented a revolutionary event when Chris Kibczynski publicly criticized the mayor's office and what's happening, and by extension, the entire power structure in the city and the county because of the lawlessness on the streets. And then that just dissipated. He was told to shut up, and he shut up, and everybody else did too, except Sam Sanchez, because you're allowed to applaud. So he applauds Lightfoot and blame shifts to people who are not up for election now, and then we'll just continue to do the musical chairs depending on who's up for election. And that's fine. Just play dress up, have a karaoke contest, make sure Lollapalooza comes back. Keep it fun. Keep it light. Tell us that we've accomplished so much, but there's a lot of more work to do.
Joey says
stay the course.
Collectively, we need to work together, blah, blah, blah.
Stay the course and focus on your navel, your identity in this identitarian city. It's fun. Self-indulgence is fun. And there's no cost to it. Unless you run into one of these guys on electronic monitoring, of course. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Economists are weighing in on the projected impact on housing prices of the Fed's activity, specifically increasing interest rates. And I'll give you a couple of examples here. Jeremy Siegel, who's a professor of finance at Wharton. I expect housing prices to fall 10 to 15%, and the housing prices are accelerating on the downside. He added, I think we're going to have the second biggest housing price decline since the post-World War II period over the next 12 months. Very significant factor for wealth and for equity in the housing market, meaning the decline in both. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's, and John McCain's favorite economist. Buckle in, assuming rates remain near their current 6.5% and the economy skirts recession, national house prices will fall almost 10% peak to trough. Most of those declines will happen sooner rather than later. And if there is a typical recession, house prices will be down 20%. So if you're looking to buy, you may want to hold off for a few months because more price cuts are coming, is what I'm reading, for reaction to those assessments and discussion on other topics. Pleased to be joined by Jim Urio, who's a Fox Business analyst and the proprietor of Brandt's Restaurant in Palatine. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
So what do you say to Zandi and Siegel and some of these other economists that are more or less saying the same things about the housing market and what that means for the larger economy?
So I'm fine with their assessment, particularly in the 10% range. Here's what I think one of the problems are with people of our era is that we think back to the 2007-2008 period when housing collapsed. But people forget that that sort of bubble implosion was dependent on decades of position buildup. And what I'm saying is, like, back then, remember that, you know, your brother-in-law was a plumber, owned five houses that he was turning around and reselling, and everybody had extended into the housing market, and then when everything turned, plus there was the adjustable rate mortgage thing. Everybody had adjustable rate mortgage, and as those rates adjusted higher, people could no longer afford their mortgages as we went into recession. That's not happening here. Everybody who bought their homes bought them at outstanding interest rates over the last couple of years. And now, so the 10% correction is perfectly fine with me, and that's just a matter of math, what you can afford. If you're someone who's planning on mortgaging, you know, 80-90% of your home, you have what you can afford has gone down considerably. But there's something else that's an element of it too, is people who own homes and don't need to sell them will be far, far less motivated to sell them because we don't want to part with our sub 3% mortgage. So that affects the supply portion of it too. And that's why I think 10% is the reasonable estimate. And beyond that, I don't think will happen.
So I hear this a lot, that we're not re-blowing up the bubble that we blew up, as you were saying, over an extended period of time leading into the Great Recession of 08, 09. But by the same token, I, you know, read what we did in the wake of 08 and 09 and good write-ups on that from people like Bethany McLean, who wrote The Smartest Guys in the Room about the Enron scandal. And I'll just say, actually, we have government more involved in the housing market after the 08-09, you know, under the auspices of regulation and protection. And what we are doing with Fannie and Freddie is the same things we were doing prior to 08 and 09. And you have the same moral hazards. And so you have actually the same dangers that are present. Maybe there's not as much, as you say, signature loans for second and third homes. Okay, fine. But don't you still have the potential of a contagion because of the externalities that exist per this expanded government involvement in the housing market?
Sure. And it's so funny when you mention it, because were they doing the wrong things as they did before the run-up to 2007 and 8? Absolutely. They were doing them probably even more aggressively. My only contention is that they didn't have enough time to screw things up as bad as they would have had the mitigation strategies not happened, had the rampant inflation not happened and caused them to panic and do what they're doing now. But as far as – so here, you know, you guys – I'm sure you know Brian Westbury, one of my friends.
And yeah, sure.
Absolutely outstanding economist.
First Trust.
And he's a monetarist like I am. And what he way he describes is this, and this is going to get to a point, I swear to God. But if you have 10 apples only and the entire economy exists of $10 and each apple by definition is worth $1, all of a sudden you increase the amount of dollars to $15 and each of those apples goes up in value because it's a question of how many dollars are out there chasing how many goods. My point is that when these guys were talking about that everything's a bubble, they were missing the point. Everything can't be a bubble. What happened just is the dollar, we've added so many dollars to the system that in reality, those things have gone up in value because there's more dollars chasing them. So the fact that all of a sudden we're trying to right the ship right now, there's still $6 trillion extra dollars pumped into the economy. I'm talking about the M2 money supply that's gone up in the last 3 years. So those dollars still exist. And until those are dragged out of the economy, I think things could keep their price better than we expect them to on the downside, if that makes sense. And again, I will go back to even in the tech stock, in the tech bubble, remember, everyone you'd have dinner with was like, oh, yeah, I could put everything in tech stocks on leverage. I mean, this train is a runaway train. I want to be on it. I'm like, yeah, you're a runaway train that's heading into a brick wall. But I don't see that right now. I did not see people mortgaging up to buy stuff. Did you?
No. I mean, there's no indication of that. I agree with you. So sort of a baseline here to put this in perspective, when we talk about interest rates, 3% versus 6 or 6.5%. Make sure I've got the handle right on this, because I want to try and translate it for people. When you mention reduced purchasing power. So for every percentage point increase in interest rates, you lose about 10%. Of your purchasing power. So if it goes from 3 to 6, then you can afford a house that was 30% that's 30% less than what you could have afforded when rates were at 3%.
Yeah, I don't have the exact calculation in front of me. That sounds right about what I've seen before too. That makes perfect sense to me. But again, so when people hear that said, and I'm not trying to say that things are rosy, because they're certainly not rosy. I think we're heading into a recession that every day I think could be worse, considering the things that the government is doing to push it along. But to your point, that presupposes that everybody who's buying a house is doing so, you know, on the maximum leverage. So does it matter? It matters a ton, but it's easy to get into this think of, well, then prices are going down this amount because of purchase power. But no, that's not everybody's situation.
Right. And in the market, there's a lot of differentiation in the market. You know, so there's obviously much more speculative markets in some places versus others.
Amen. Remember, too, that who was buying the houses in the run-up, too? 18% of them were bought by investment trusts, things like BlackRock. So it's not exactly weak hand that's going to all of a sudden turn around and go, shoot, I can't afford my mortgage payments anymore and sell it out.
Well, so what does that mean? I said one more on this housing, then we. But what does that mean when we see J.P. Morgan partnering with a realty outfit and they're planning on spending $1 billion buying up homes to rent out? What is that telling us about the housing market?
I see nothing good about that. I think it's a terrible thing. I think it's these places trying to find places to park money. But in the end, I think that us becoming a renter society is an awful thing. I'm a big fan of home ownership, and that seems like the wrong direction we're going in right now. So it's a mixed bag. As Thomas Sowell always says, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. So right now, if those concerns are coming in and supporting the market, it could you know, make the price collapse a little bit easier than it could have been. But ultimately, I certainly don't want BlackRock being the landlord and me being the renter. That sounds awful to me.
Yeah, but why do you think it's bad to rent as opposed to own?
Well, I think that's a great question. It always seems to me that just like, you know, this, whenever the World Economic Forum says, you know, in 2035, you'll own nothing and be happy. I'm like, the hell with that. I want to own lots of stuff. And I don't particularly, you don't need to concern yourself with my happiness. I think that ownership and the when people in a society try to increase their lot in life by increasing ownership and increasing stake, I think it's a better thing. I think it's just as simple as that.
I wanted to get your take on, you mentioned that we're going into recession. So there's been a lot of fanfare surrounding the layoffs, not in a positive way, just attention surrounding the layoffs in big tech companies, you know, 10,000 at Amazon and 8,000 at Meta and so on and so forth. But now we're starting to see it in other sectors, too. There was a story over the weekend about a big furniture manufacturer that's located in Mississippi. They just laid off 2,700 workers in one fell swoop. So I guess what we're saying is, well, this is exactly what was predicted. This is what the Fed is intending to do. They're nuking your brokerage accounts and they're turning people out of their jobs. This is the way we're going to curb inflation. So don't be surprised when you hear and see these headlines about layoffs.
No, no doubt about it. Remember, Jay Powell came out and said he wants to see slack in the labor market. And that's a really benign way of saying he wants you to lose your job. Remember, the whole time they're not, when they say there's going to be some pain, they mean pain with us. They don't mean pain with them. They're insulated from every moronic policy they put forward. So, but the last shoe to drop has to be the labor market. Because remember, there's two different kinds of inflation. There's a cost push inflation, which is, you know, input prices going up, think 70s oil. And we're certainly involved in that now. But the thing that terrifies them the worst is the wage price spiral, because that starts to go and it's very, very difficult to get us out of that pattern. So one of the reasons they've been so aggressive, despite the fact that everybody's telling them now that perhaps they've gone far enough, is they need to see slack in the labor market, which they need to see a lot of people losing their job. And you mentioned all those layoffs coming this time of year, you know, the big retail, the big big season for hiring people, to see layoffs in this time is very troubling. And to me, that number, those layoffs that we hear anecdotally are going to start to work themselves into the official numbers released by the government over the next couple of weeks. And that's why I think the Fed is probably going to go 50 basis points to the next meeting in 16 days. And that's probably going to be it, because they'll realize at that point in time they've probably gone too far.
Well, if that happens, then,
bad time to get a car loan.
But not only that, if that happens and you continue to see unemployment, then that's going to be good news for Wall Street.
It's the weird, weird, ironic thing is that bad economic data is good for Wall Street. My friend Larry Kudlow and I, and yes, you guys know I'm not above name dropping. My friend Larry Kudlow and I have had this ongoing argument for years where he says profits are the mother's milk of the stock market, and I say that's nonsense. I think that Fed policy is the mother's milk of the stock market, meaning that as soon as the market realizes that the Fed can't go any further with rates, they'll start to feel more comfortable in stocks. And they could go higher. And I can prove that. The last couple of weeks, every time there's a number came out that disappoints even a little, the stock market rallies on it. The stock market wants this recession. They want to get it over with before they can rally.
All right. So I want to get your take on FTX, the meltdown there with SBF, the kingpin of the Democrats' socialist fundraising, or at least once upon a time, like 5 minutes ago he was. And the argument is, well, if FTX were a U.S. stock on the exchange, then regulations would have required user funds be held by an outside custodian, orders routed through a brokerage. And so that sort of structure would have prevented what happened to FTX. But that's not actually true, is it? Because fraud can be committed within that structure. You had Enron, which was on the NYSE, and what happened with Enron. So is there something sort of just more fundamental at play here than thinking that if you provided more government structure to the crypto markets, that would prevent things like FTX?
No, I think what you're saying is very, very reasonable. That you can put all the regulations in place, and we've seen historically that people choose to not follow those regulations and then cover up their path of not doing that. So, yes, of course it could happen anywhere. The thing that with FTX is that, and first of all, I think the flow of funds within the whole FTX situation should be picked apart with a fine-tooth comb, and any weird abnormality should become public. I don't have confidence in that because it always seems like, and I'm not pointing fingers, but if you contribute to the right campaign, you don't get investigated as difficult. And yes, this is a sticking point with everybody here. But your point is that when people are losing all their money in a crypto exchange, where were they domiciled in the Bahamas? I mean, it seems like such a stupid thing to put all your money in. And the things we're hearing about Tom Brady, it's really $655 million, which I have a hard time believing that. That it's unbelievable to me that someone would be so reckless with their money, and then I would just say a fool and his money are soon to part, so either today or tomorrow. But there's one thing I do want to say about this whole thing is that, remember, the point of Bitcoin, and I'm not a crazy Bitcoin guy, but the point of Bitcoin was decentralization. And this FTX yes. thing was just about centralization. So it's not a commentary on Bitcoin. The fact that Bitcoin has been just crushed by this, to me, seems a little bit ironic. But the reality of it is that, yeah, to your point, of course, it can happen anywhere. I don't want more regulation. I want people to do their own due diligence. And if you're stupid, you should part with your money.
And from what you know, I mean, sort of morally, not even necessarily legally, you'd like to see Sam Bankman freed, imprisoned somewhere, but like on Easter Island, as far as I'm concerned. But that's which is not to say that I have sympathy for Tom Brady, because I don't. But what is your take? I mean, should he be treated like the guys at Enron? Should he be treated like Ken Lay and Skilling?
Oh, I think of course he should. But again, yeah. you got to find an exact. Again, he was domiciled in a different area, so you got to find exactly what laws he broke. Which I'm again at this point in time, it's speculation. But my guess is when something like this happens, and the things I've heard sound completely ridiculous, and so absolutely I think he should be treated harshly. And this is what frustrates people and why they lose confidence in the system when they see that, you know, that Bernie Madoff is arrested 24 hours after the story breaks, and nobody's even thought of arresting SBF and questioning him, and he's going to appear in a New York Times panel this week and be interviewed. This just blows me away.
Yeah, right.
The politicians should give the money back?
Well, how about give it back to the people who he scammed it out of? Right. Like, give it. Absolutely. Remember in the Bernie Madoff thing, it was years later when people got a phone call that said, "Yeah, remember that? You know, that $100 million you took out 5 years ago, it wasn't really yours. You got to give it back." Of course they should. But again, who's going to force them to do that? We've given them all the power, and we continue to give them more and more power. They're not going to do that. So we have to keep our wish list reasonable. But yeah, to your point, absolutely they should.
And we find out if he's too big to imprison like John Corzine when MF Global went mm-hmm. under with very dubious legal practice, because of very dubious practices legally as well.
Perfect comparison. John Corzine had small, tiny outs where they said, oh, I could invest in sovereign debt. Yeah, you weren't supposed to invest in sovereign debt in third world countries that had wildly high volatility. So should John Corzine have gone to prison? Of course he should have. But, yeah, he wiggled his way up. But that's a perfect comparison. A powerful person who has contacts in the government, has contacts with Goldman Sachs, which I can never – again, I'm a Goldman Sachs alum, but I can never figure if they're the government or if they're a private entity. But let's scratch that out. When the show goes live, let's cut that out. So
All right. Well, that will be left on the cutting room floor. Yes. No worries. So Jim Urio, Fox Business Analyst for now, and proprietor of Brandt's Restaurant in Palatine as well. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. I'll see you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Attention, Prospect High School's parents.
The Knights.
If you don't want your
The Knights. They're the Knights. Prospect High School Knights.
There you go. If you don't want your teen participating in a upcoming SEL session, that would be social emotional learning, on Tuesday, like tomorrow, excuse them. Parents elsewhere, watch for these types of sessions in your district. It's your decision whether your children participate. Yeah, apparently District 214, Prospect High School, they're welcoming guest speaker Calvin Terrell in for tutorial on social emotional learning, which is just another way of saying CRT and identitarian politics. Calvin Terrell is a someone who survived violence. Calvin Terrell transforms pain into power and haunts into healing. Surviving violence, losing loved ones to addictions, murder, white supremacy, and misogyny, as well as owning his own prejudices and role in oppression, compels Calvin's service. Yeah. His approaches draw from many technologies that are colonial, decolonized, and indigenous. Wonderful. And he posts things like this on social media. To stop hate, open your mind. Mind your business if you disagree, but please don't spew dog whistles that lead to terrorism. Love you and blessings. And as an expression of his love, that comment was accompanied by a cartoon featuring, I'm guessing, Lauren Boebert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and Tucker Carlson with blood around their mouths, and a LGBTQ plus flag with bullet holes in it and blood dripping from those bullet holes. Cause, those three, affect the bullet holes and the blood dripping from them on the flag. Mm-hmm. Right. Love you and blessings. Okay, Cal. Uh-huh. And he's got other things about fascism, which he equates to conservatism, even though they're antonyms. Yeah, evening event for parents and community, November 29th at 7 p.m. at Prospect KLC. What, I don't know what that is. Maybe it's a learning center or something. I don't know. But anyway, it's at Prospect High School. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because there's a lot of prattling on in his postings about democracy, democracy, democracy. And maybe we haven't put too fine a point on it, but it reminds me of a call we got a week ago Friday in our Open Mic Friday, where somebody asked to distinguish between democracy and a republic. Are we a republic? Are we a democracy? Threats to our democracy. Protect our democracy. Democracy, democracy, democracy.
It's under attack.
Right. We're a representative republic governed by a constitution. We're a constitutional republic. And, you know, maybe there's something to be gleaned by the left's constant parroting of the word democracy as opposed to republic or referencing our constitutional republic, because they're not really so much interested in our constitutional republic. They're interested in mob rule. They're interested in 50% plus one make something right. They're not interested in majority rule and minority rights, the minority rights protected by the Constitution, which you see them make every attempt to trample over. Yeah, maybe there's a reason. Democracy, democracy, democracy. I know it's an easy handle. I know those phrases are used interchangeably. For some people, it's just ignorance. For other people, I think it's purposeful. For more of what happened, oh, by the way, I should mention.
Yeah.
Because we have school board elections, too. We talked about last day of filing for the Chicago mayor's race today. The last day of filing to run for school board where you live is December 19th. The school board members, District 214, which includes Prospect High School, I think the ones that are up, William Dussling, the board members are William Dussling, Millie Palmer, Mark Heineman, Alva Kreutzer, Dan Petro, Andrea Rauch, and Lenny Walker. And I think Palmer, Heineman, Rausch, and Walker are up. I mean, just, you know, maybe you have some questions for them about this Calvin Terrell invited to spew his leftist propaganda. And again, you want to bring Calvin Terrell in, like we talked about with the Nutrier I Hate White People Day several years ago that got discontinued?
Bring in a countering opinion.
Expand, don't contract. Go ahead, bring Calvin Terrell in. And bring Calvin Terrell in, and he has to square off against, oh, I don't know, say Paul Rossi. Or, you know, there's myriad others to choose from. But, yeah. So, no, you can bring Cornel West in. You can talk about Cornel West's writings and so on and so forth. But then also include Thomas Sowell. What's wrong with that? Why is it that you only want one point of view presented and you don't want different point of views presented side by side? Isn't that a curious thing?
I wonder how much he's getting paid, too. Because this is a business for him.
Oh, it's a business. Oh, it's definitely a business.
On his Twitter page, it's very... It's
District 214 is getting the business. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Frank McCormick again. He is a teacher, historian. He's also writes over at chalkboardheresy.com, chalkboardheresy.com. And by the way, bring Frank McCormick in to go point counterpoint with Calvin Terrell. Wouldn't that be fun? He's local. Hey, Frank, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me again. Appreciate it.
So social emotional learning, you're in the trenches. You're still, you haven't been thrown out of your school yet, have you?
Oh, no, that ended in January.
Oh, it did.
Well, remind people what happened.
I basically sort of decided to be openly conservative online and start a blog, and then thought to myself, you know, what if I do the opposite of everything they expect you to do? So instead of back down, I would respond back, and kind of got in a one-man war with my school district, Waukegan High School. And, you know, don't regret it, though. A lot came to the surface, and there were other teachers across the country doing the same thing. And now we're just trying to kind of continue informing the public about what's really going on in their schools.
Do you want to continue teaching?
I would like to, but you become kind of blacklisted. It's almost like...
Well, what about at a you know, I mean... private Catholic school, something like that. I mean, I know that even those are limited in terms of options that will endure any criticism of this sort. But what about that?
Yeah, that's a possibility, but they're pretty risk averse as well. Yeah. They this is something I've talked to Paul Rossi about, and the problem. Paul Rossi thinks it's almost just as bad, if not worse, in private schools because they're trying to appease kind of this woke faction of parents that they don't want to cause a lot of trouble for them. So it's pretty risky to do, but, you know, people have to know what's going on.
So getting back to Calvin Terrell and this this SEL workshop tomorrow night at Prospect High School. So, you know, from your experience at Waukegan and just knowing teachers and writing about this stuff, so how ubiquitous are the Calvin Terrells in K-12?
You know, what he, when you read what he writes online, it, I understand the public is shocked, but it's not a surprise to me. These people are brought in all the time, not necessarily in such a public fashion, and typically they're a lot more discreet about their views, so that's, you're kind of getting something different with Calvin Terrell. He's really open about it. But none of this is new, none of this is surprising. They, you know, schools and teachers just aren't used to the public knowing as much as they now know and as much as they're finding out. They've been doing this for years, if not, you know, over a decade, and it's just now coming to light. But I think people are still trying to wrap their heads around it because the language changes and evolves so much. And these terms, you know, SEL, people understand that there's things they don't like about it, but they don't understand really at the root what SEL is and why it's dangerous.
Well, explain and, SEL and why, what it is and why it's dangerous.
Sure. So SEL, basically on the surface, it sounds nice. It fosters social and emotional skills. The catch is, who decides what is proper socialization? Who decides what an emotional skill looks like? So, for example, we could agree SEL, which teaches kids to respect other people's privacy, is a good thing. But often the architects of SEL will argue something like, healthy socialization involves awareness of inequity, or that empathy for oppressed groups is an emotional skill kids should possess. So I've described SEL as like a Trojan horse. And it's ultimately a Trojan horse for this revolution that many of these radical, or what they call them, critical pedagogists, want. They want a revolution. You need revolutionaries. And to get that, you have to develop a new type of consciousness. And so I urge people to look in not just in SEL, but a lot of it is called transformative SEL. And transformative SEL is this process where young people and adults, and this is their definition, build relationships to develop critical consciousness together. And critical consciousness is basically neo-Marxism. you know, where Marxism was class consciousness, recognizing systemic and structural oppression. In a class system, critical consciousness is about recognizing oppression everywhere in the broader scale, and gender can be applied to anything. And the key thing here is this is not just academic. They sometimes sell it that way. They say, well, we're just exploring the world through a critical lens. A major part of critical theory and developing critical consciousness is activism. So you have this new consciousness, you're woke to the truth, you recognize the oppressor class, or you're, you know, now your kids do. Hey, kids, you've developed this new consciousness, you recognize structural inequality and systemic oppression. What are you going to do about it? Well, you help more people develop critical consciousness, and then you need a political revolution towards equity. That's where that, you know, we've all heard that in schools now, right? Equity. Equity is about giving everyone what they need according to their abilities. Sounds familiar.
Yeah, right.
Those of us familiar with Marxism. So that's where SEL often leads. It's hard to, it's really hard to wrap your head around, but SEL is ultimately about reaching these kind of ends. And it sounds like a conspiracy until you actually read what these educational professors, people at teachers' colleges, what they're writing about, or if you, like,
well,
in
also,
my case, been through it.
Well, also when you start to connect the dots back to K through 12, through college,
yep,
to CNN stories this weekend, Daylight Savings Time sheds light on lack of sleep's disproportionate impact in communities of color. Daylight Savings Time is racist. Seriously. Jaywalking laws.
Yeah.
Arbitrarily enforced and tickets disproportionately given to people of color in low-income communities. Jaywalking is racist.
Red light
everything
cameras
is,
are racist.
Everything is forced through the identitarian prism, you know, and depending on, you know, what your predilection is, whether race comes first or gender identity comes first, but it's all that everywhere all the time.
Yeah, critical theory has definitely infiltrated so many different aspects of our society and culture that we're just now starting to wake up to. And I think a lot of people, they know what's wrong, but they don't necessarily have the language to describe it yet, which is why I think it's really important to, like, read the people who are authoring these books and these studies, who are, you know, go to Terrell's speech, hear what he has to say, learn about it. Like, you'll be shocked, but you need to be shocked. But what's really insidious about this for me is that, and this is why I decided to speak out in the beginning, was they're targeting schools for a reason. They've kind of given up on adults. So they're starting with kids because they circumvent the problem of having to convince adults of their political solution. That, I mean, that's what indoctrination is. And
well,
they actually write about that, too.
Yeah, but the adults have ceded control to the kids, so the adults just get rolled over. Right, they don't need the adults.
Well, yeah, and they have an incredible amount of faith in, you know, you hear this all the time in schools. Children are the future. Children can run the classrooms. Children can run the schools. Children will run the world. They want that if kids are in line with their kind of ideology. And there's a lot of parallels to the Cultural Revolution, which was a student-led revolution in China as well. And it was the same kind of idea that children are the future and they should be running things. And
yeah, don't tell me how the Cultural Revolution in China ended. You know, let's let it be a surprise. Robert Pondicio over at American Enterprise Institute wrote this piece last year about SEL, he takes sort of one step back, which I like, and I think this is a nice framing of a conversation about this with parents. He writes, inherent in SEL is an under-discussed change in the role of the teacher, from a pedagogue to something more closely resembling a therapist, social worker, or member of the clergy, no less concerned with the child's beliefs, attitudes, and values. At the very least, the rise of SEL, under the cover of jargon and education ease, has become largely a largely unquestioned feature of mainstream education, thought, and practice, with insufficient discussion and debate about its effects on schools' missions. The more salient question, he says, is, which tends to go unasked, must be self-heard. Is this the appropriate business of the school? And the answer is no, because, for example, he points out, teachers are not well-equipped to deal with these issues, and As he writes, the potential negative consequences for students, as damaging to children as it might be for a teacher to perform poorly at teaching reading, math, or history, the effect of being a poor mental health professional could be even more dire.
Absolutely. And actually, my theory is that even though I completely understand and agree with what you're saying, the reason they've gone this route is because they failed in their fundamental mission. So they're looking desperately for something to be successful at. And so they're trying their hand at drugstore psychology now. But it's going to have even more disastrous results. Or if it goes the way they've planned with this transformative SEL, then it may work out very well for them. Because I still think SEL fundamentally, I think there's some, you know, stuff on the surface that looks good. But I think fundamentally what it's about is advancing the political agenda kind of under the guise of pseudo-psychology.
And just going back to your experience, you were at Waukegan High School, right?
Yeah.
So when you decided to push back in a substantive way, like you're explaining today, you know, on the merits, school board members, other teachers, parents of any of your students, anybody rally to your defense on this? Anybody say, you may disagree with Frank, but he's a good history teacher and we want him at the school? Any of that?
Nope, not one. I had some quiet support, but no one dared risk their pension or their salary. They say, I agree with you, you know. Yeah, I know it's a real danger to the Republic what's happening in our schools. Will you say something? Nope. Wow. And that's the problem.
And was that from teachers or from students or parents?
I get it from a few teachers, a few administrators. They say, just quietly off the record, please don't say anything. And I'm out there. I'm like, hey, guys, like, you know, I don't want to.
How about a little help here?
Either, but
yeah.
How about a little help here? Surprisingly, a lot of the support, believe it or not, came from many of my former students who knew that I was a good teacher and who I had a relationship with and said, you know what? They said, I don't understand everything you're saying. This is kind of new to me, like, you know, your kind of theory on where this goes. But they said, I trust you. And if you think this is important, I'm going to start paying attention to it.
So are they, can you get your teacher's pension?
Well, they tried. So yeah, they basically, you kind of lose it when you leave, unless you're vested. I was vested, but you know, it was basically, you know, pennies compared. It's a pyramid scheme, you know, as we know, but so you get very little back. But what they did try and do is they brought me in with a district attorney. This was around December, and it was just like an intimidation meeting. They brought me in, and they read me the code of teacher ethics. So I think what they were trying to do is they were kind of lining up their shot to go after my teaching license.
Oh, my God.
He is Frank McCormick, teacher, historian, and he writes at chalkboardheresy.com, chalkboardheresy.com. You know, it's not enough to know what's going on. We're going to have some people that are willing to stand with people like Frank McCormick and act in furtherance of what you know is right. And that job has not been sufficiently filled yet in most school districts, as we've seen. Frank, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
'Cause they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Dan and Amy, yeah, on this installment of Campus Beat, following on the discussion we had with former Waukegan history teacher Frank McCormick, Waukegan High School history teacher Frank McCormick, about social-emotional learning and the culture in K through 12. Of course, that culture owes so much to academia that started there and moved backwards to the primary and secondary grades. This story out of Gainesville, the University of Florida pulled a scholarship it gave to one of the nation's top quarterback recruits after a video of him using the N-word while singing along to the lyrics in a rap song surfaced. Marcus Stokes, who played for Nice High School in Ponte Vedra, was ranked the 14th best quarterback in the nation. But that wasn't enough to persuade Florida to keep him after the video surfaced. He wrote on social media, "I was in my car listening to rap music, rapping along to the words, and posted a video of it on social media. I deeply apologize for the words in the song that I chose to say. It was hurtful and offensive to many people, and I regret it. He fully accepted the consequences of his actions, and he respects the University of Florida's decision to withdraw his scholarship, saying, my intention was never to hurt anybody, and I recognize that even when going along with a song, my words still carry a lot of weight. I will strive to be better and to become the best version of myself, both on and off the field. I know that learning from my mistakes is a first important step." 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Now remember, University of Florida is not just a state school in the state of Florida. It's also a state school that just hired Ben Sasse to be its incoming president. Much to the chagrin and protestations of Florida, University of Florida undergrads, but nonetheless, just because he was not a Trump fan doesn't mean, you know, as a Republican from Nebraska, he's not also a white supremacist, hate monger, fear monger, and a threat to our democracy. So with that context, how do you like that? I just want to get my kid through school. I just want to get my kid to this. I just want my kid to have that. And hopefully nothing ever happens that would unleash the mob on my kid or my family. But you never can tell, can you?
Well, I think people need to keep in mind, these are kids. This is, you know, and kids and social media, I'm grateful we didn't have it when we were growing up. My God. But you have to tell them all the time, too, be careful what you post. It will come back to haunt you. And what he did, though, you know, look at what he did. He was singing along and said the N-word, which was part of a rap song. And we all know certain people can say the N-word, and I would never in my life ever say that. But I've seen other people do it, and, you know, I feel bad for him. He's a kid, but his apology was so sincere, and I just wish that they could move on. Like, we accept his apology, and we're going to keep him.
Should he apologize?
Should he have apologized to try and keep his scholarship? Yeah, I would have advised him, yes. And the apology that was written, I thought, was absolutely perfect. But still, it's not enough. Do you think he should have apologized?
No. Absolutely not. Really? Absolutely 100% unequivocally not. Just stick your kid with the jab. Just apologize. Just bend the knee. Just do this and do that because you are in service to our ideology. No, I don't think so. Nope. If he was my kid, absolutely not. Under no circumstances. Under no circumstances. Some teenager is singing along to a rap song in his car.
I need to see this, yeah.
But I don't know what rap song, it hasn't been reported, but it's like, welcome back, and then it's like, you know, something N-word, and he's singing, and he's posting on social media because, you know, it's like an irresistible force for kids. And he says that completely innocently. And he should lose his scholarship, or even if it would have been conditional, unless you apologize, you lose your scholarship. Take the scholarship and stick it someplace dark. That would be my attitude.
312.
And let me just say something else. And until and unless people start taking that attitude, then this steamroll will come for you and your family in some form or fashion. Do you think his parents or he ever thought? No. But when you live in a society where these universities and now K-12 school systems have trained generations of young people to be Stasi cadets, to go out and look for people to jackpot, to go out and treat your neighbor, cast your neighbor in the light least favorable to him or her for the purposes of ratting them out so they can be properly punished and taught to follow orders, taught to repeat what you're told, not think for yourself. It will come. We've been telling these stories that cancel is such a therapeutic way to describe this. We've been telling these stories for years and years and years, and nobody ever thinks it will come for them until it does. Your company's taken away, your kid's scholarship's taken away, you're booted from this job or that opportunity. So go ahead. I just want to get my kid through school. For what purpose?
God, he went on to say, I quote, "I fully accept the consequences of my actions, and I respect the University of Florida's decision to withdraw my scholarship offer to play football."
Yeah, right. I'm going to repeat the lines I've been told to repeat. I'm at fault here. So you're saying you should admit you're at fault for something you didn't do. In other words, you uttered the word because you were rapping along to a song, but you're not, you know, a racist. You're not attacking black people with a racial slur and so on and so forth. You did that as a kid. But here's the thing. I know that argument that you made at the outset. Thank God we didn't have social media when we were kids. If you think that at all inhibits these Gruppenführers at the collegiate level and all of the Stasi cadets they've trained and dispersed among the populace, if you think that inhibits them for a second, then you have no idea what's happening. You're not paying attention to what's happening.
He was going to go to Penn State and then changed it to Florida last July.
We'll see where he can go, if anywhere now. Who's going to stand up for him?
Well, he received more than a dozen offers from D1 college programs.
That was before this.
Right. Now who's going to take him?
And this will be an early test for Ben Sass, too. I mean, he doesn't assume the job until February, I believe. But this should be revisited. If I'm president of that university, that I'm not, there's no way I'm going to be president of a university, and that's going to be the culture under my stewardship. Go down fighting. Somebody's got to, right? Or no? Just hey, whatever you want, I'm happy to live on my knees. That's what I want to teach my children too. Live on your knees. Whether you're right or wrong, whoever has power, you just accede to their wishes. Well, you know, you do things for people in power because they have power, not because it's right or wrong. Boy, it can take you to some very strange, destructive, dark places, can it? Do we know anything about history? I mean, really, the Nuremberg defense? Are we that afraid that you actually have people invoking the Nuremberg defense and acting in furtherance of it? He didn't do anything wrong. Nothing wrong. Except listen to bad music. That was his crime. So fine, so Florida loses a quarterback. That's not the point. The point is this is the culture, and it's not just on the campus of the University of Florida, clearly. And the response, the immediate response is, surrender. Why do you think it's so hard to change what's going on in K-12, even when, as Frank McCormick is telling us, even when there are people that are silently with you because they're silently with you? I don't want anything to happen to my kid. Oh, you think silence will protect your kid from anything happening? All you're doing is aggrandizing the power of the thug class. Is that not clear? Has nobody lived on this planet for 5 minutes? The cowardice. The cowardice is astounding to me. For a scholarship, take your scholarship. For a job, take your job. Maurice and Berwin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, Dan, I have to agree with you. As someone who's looking at the front 50, I couldn't listen to rap growing up in my household as an African-American because I had strict parents. But my theory has always been, if it's in the song, it's in the song. There is a difference between someone saying that word to you full of hate and the way they use it in rap songs. But to me, as I was telling your screener, it's a reflection of society. I like Fleetwood with Mac, and my favorite song Fleetwood Mac is, you know, I can't say the word anymore, G. You know, there goes your G, you know, as Stephen Nixon say it. You can't say that word anymore because of younger people. I think younger people are just so hypersensitive that nothing you do is appropriate anymore. And so if you know the G word, the G song I'm talking about, Fleetwood Mac, someone say, oh, that's a slur now. Like, since when? Everything is an overcorrection in which we all kind of get caught in these smaller boxes all the time. So I feel sorry for the kid, but it's, I feel like there's nothing you can do because younger people are taking over society.
Well, yeah, but there is something you can do. The people in charge or the people that have platforms or the people that are part of these organizations can say, I am not participating in insanity. I'm not participating in what is actually intolerance and ignorance. I'm not going to be part of promoting that. And who says that? Who says it?
I have to agree with you. I think that is a fear that if, even for me as an older, registered Democrat, I'm so conservative compared to younger people now in societal shift, I might as well be one of you guys.
Because then you're really in trouble. But the difference is, the difference, Maurice, is we'll stand up and defend you.
Well, thanks, Dan.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks for the call, Maurice. I mean, that is. We'll come, we'll rally to, like, that's the whole thing, rally to the defense of people who are being wrongly persecuted. I thought that was, that's the lesson from the darkest periods in our history. You rally to the defense of people who are being unjustly persecuted. But now it's, no, okay, all right, don't take that away from me. Yeah. And you get to keep your scholarship and you lose your humanity. That's a great trade-off. Steve in Downers Grove.
Well, Dan, I wish you were running the University of Florida. I'd hate to lose you up here, but you'd be a good fit down there. Listen, real quick, two things. I was watching CNN Loser Lemon last week in the morning. He had on a black guest. So it was two black guys talking. And right there on live TV, the black guest used the N-word. Nobody said a thing. It didn't bother anybody. They just kept going. So it was perfectly fine. Had this Florida quarterback been black and not white, nothing would have happened.
Well, of course. Thanks for the call. I mean, you know, Dave Chappelle used it twice in his monologue on SNL that went out, you know, over the public airwaves. I mean, it used to be, as I said when we were talking about Chappelle's monologue, go back and watch episodes of Sanford and Son. Go back and watch episodes of All in the Family. But you have to watch those things in context, just like you have to listen to Chappelle in context. Obviously, I'm not here to call on Dave Chappelle to apologize or what. You have to look at things in context, but they don't do that. They don't afford context to people that they see as oppressors because of their skin color, and that is rank ignorance. But who's standing up for the kid? Not even him. He won't even stand up for himself. Why? Because he's been trained not to.
Right.
That's sad.
Totally caved.
Jordan in Antioch.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Dan, I'm with you 100%. There should be no apology, and that kid's parents should be standing behind him, telling them there's not going to be an apology. You know, the kid was singing to a song on the radio and then was videoing himself, which is the exact reason why I have a son who we've had the long talk about social media. And he has no social media apps on his phone. He doesn't participate for this reason. And we will talk about this when I get home. And I saw your tweet about this, and I thought it was comical how the immediate reaction, without even knowing what the context of the story was they slammed you, your gubernatorial race, your PAC, and that you were a racist.
Yeah, of course.
You know, right. You're a racist because the kid. So the funny thing is, this music is catered to kids his age. They know exactly who their market is. It's white suburban kids who want to listen to rap and feel like they live street life. And then they sing the song and they lambaste them and make them pay for it. My son.
Yeah, exactly. You know who the rap audience is? I mean, obviously there's an urban audience for rap too.
And then they punish them. Yeah.
But the reason that so many of these rap artists are kajillionaires is because, I mean, here's the quintessential scene. Michael Bolton in his car in the opening scene of Office Space. That's who that's who listens to rap.
So we have talked
myself
about
included, by the way.
My son, Yeah, my son understands, and he's got friends. He's put in too much work academically and athletically. He has college prospects, and he wants to go. That's why he has no social media. But I've always told him, and he knows 100%, and I don't think this kid has this luxury, is that as long as you're on the right side of the scripture, as long as you're on the right side of the law, and if you're honest with me and what you did was not wrong in your heart and in the scripture, I will stand behind you, and I will have that meeting with those teachers. I will have the meeting with anybody else, and I will defend you until the end. And I don't think this kid has that. He's been taught to roll over. And you're
right. Thanks for the call, Jordan. Well, and the other thing too is, you know, he's not important. He's a acceptable casualty. Ralph Northam in blackface, Justin Trudeau in blackface. Yeah. Those are not acceptable casualties because they occupy positions of authority that the left wants to hold on to. So we'll leave them there.
Yep. But to promote yourself, though, you have to be on Twitter as an athlete. Coaches don't want to hear from parents. They want to, and coaches follow Twitter. And that's how, you know, he got onto that social media. And then somebody dug deep and found something that he had done months ago.
Right.
We're going to destroy him now.
Right. One of those Stasi cadets trained at, no doubt, at one of our institutions of higher learning. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Dan and Amy, yes, it's an extended edition of Campus Beat this morning because we need to get to this story.
But I thought the school bell already rang. We're in the next period now.
Well, we've returned from recess, okay, and we've got the afternoon session. Annabella Rockwell. We've got to tell the story of Annabella Rockwell.
Okay.
She is the heiress to a pharmaceutical fortune. Grew up in Manhattan. Went to Mount Holyoke, one of the Seven Sisters. Let's go lesbians. And summered in Newport, of course. Later moved with her family to Palm Beach. She was a competitive figure skater who lived abroad for a time in Germany as well as Hong Kong.
Nice. Nice privileged life.
This was before she went to Mount Holyoke. I was so excited about going to this renowned, respected school in Massachusetts. I literally arrived there bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I was just so happy. But she told the New York Post she wound up totally indoctrinated into viewing the world as a toxic patriarchy and herself as an oppressed victim. She eventually had to be deprogrammed, literally. Literally deprogrammed. Like her mother hired a deprogrammer and paid him $300 an hour to undo what Mount Holyoke did. The lengths that this is... that are being taken once you've sent your kid away to these communist indoctrination centers called universities. She said she was initially shocked at how aggressively anti-male the students and professors were when she settled into Mount Holyoke. By the way, bonus points, my undenying admiration, if anybody can name all seven sisters. I think some people can get six, but there's the seventh is, it's pretty arcane.
Well, what is the seventh?
I'm going to let people fill them in. Can you name any? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Don't say Mount Holyoke, that was given.
No, Mount Holyoke.
Yeah, right. You didn't consider any of the seven sisters?
No. Did I? No.
Really?
No. Why would I consider the seven
you,
sisters?
You strike me as a Smith girl. Okay, now two have been given away.
Uh-oh.
All right. She said she was also taken aback by the drinking culture and freshman campus rituals designed to shrug off gender roles, such as cutting your hair into what's called the moho chop.
The moho chop?
Mount Holyoke, moho chop. Cut your hair, you know, so you're a little bit more butch. But it wasn't until her junior year when she took a gender studies class that she said she was turned upside down. This is quoting Miss Rockwell. The professor tells me about the patriarchy. I barely knew what the word meant. Well, it's a testament to her K through 12 education. I didn't know what she was talking about. I wasn't someone that was into feminism. I just knew that I felt I'd always been free to do what I wanted. I never experienced sexism, but I was told that there's a patriarchy and you don't even understand it's been working against you your whole life. You've been oppressed and you didn't even know it. Now you have to fight it. And I just went down this deep rabbit hole. This is so interesting. By the time she graduated in 2015, she said she'd been brainwashed into believing she had been a lifelong victim of patriarchal oppression and had a duty to fight it on behalf of other victims, women, people of color, LGBTQ folks. I left school very anxious, very nervous, very depressed, and sad. I saw everything through the lens of oppression and bias and victimhood. I came to the school as someone who saw everyone equally. I left looking for injustice wherever I could and automatically assuming that all white men were sexist. My thoughts were no longer my own. She also became estranged from her mother, who she once considered her best friend. Her mom said that her daughter wrote a horrible manifesto right after graduation accusing her mom, her, of treating her like a wind-up toy and a doll and never loving her. Yeah, it's not, right? She was really oppressed. I felt I had to teach her how wrong she was and expose her and to do that with everyone who didn't see things correctly. The professors encouraged alienation from parents, even offered their homes to stay in. They'd say, like, don't go see them. Come stay with us for the holiday. Most of my classmates believed all this stuff, too. If you didn't, you were ostracized. Remember, this is one of these universities that's $70,000 a year. So this is a small Leninist arts school for the largely the uber wealthy and their, you know, their offspring. Laura Loomer, who I'm not a big fan of, but nonetheless, she went to Mount Holyoke for a semester before she couldn't take it anymore. The entire culture there revolved around hating men and being a lesbian. Mount Holyoke and all the Seven Sisters were designed to be these elite institutions for women at a time when places like Harvard just took men, but they're no longer places for ideas and debate and a well-rounded education. They're centers for indoctrination. If you send your kid there, you're signing them up to hate the patriarchy and white people and the founding stock of our country. It's a bastardization of higher education for the sake of weaponizing naive young women for the sake of advancing a toxic agenda. $300 a day, this person that she hired to talk to her daughter, because her daughter was alienated from her, to try to, you know, give her broader perspective on things in the world. Her mom said she was no longer the Annabella I've known all my life. This girl was the most bubbly breath of fresh air to everyone. She lit up a room, but the light was stolen from her at that school. It was extinguished. It's no different than if she'd be taken away by the Moonies or the Children of God.
Wow. Sounded like she was in a cult. You know, because people pay for that.
This
to indoctrinate.
Some of these people that are talking about trying to deprogram students who've gone to college. I mean, this deprogramming. When we call it a cult and we say that these are cultists that are practicing this pagan religion, it's no longer a metaphor. These guys say it can take years to overcome the brainwashing that Annabella now describes she went through. I couldn't push too hard or I'd lose her, but if I let go, I felt like I might not see her again. It was as bad as trying to get a child off the streets who's on heroin. Everyone is so sure it won't happen to their child, but it will. Professors and older students tell the students they are special. It's like they're anointed. And they tell them how oppressed they are and what victims they are and how they have to go out in the world and be activists to stop the oppression. Which is why, by the way, you see all sorts of asinine antics from all of these activists, all of these crusaders against oppression, and perhaps most pronounced, especially of late, are these, you know, climate apocalypse protesters who are, you know, destroying works of art and gluing themselves to basketball courts during NBA games and so on and so forth. This is where they're getting
paintings.
It. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-368, turnkey.pro text line.
one of the seven colleges that I think people forget, Radcliffe College.
Radcliffe is one. You're not allowed to look it up on Google.
It was absorbed by Harvard College in 1999. And yes, I'm reading that off of Google.
No Googling.
Well, I Googled it. But I did have a friend that went to Vassar College.
That's okay. Now you've.
But Vassar, so that's everybody knows Vassar. And I don't know one.
All right. So now four have been mentioned.
Well, Mount Hope.
But not the most difficult one.
Really?
All right. Let's see. Robert in Villa Park says he can name the Seven Sisters. Oh, boy. Okay. There we go.
Without cheating.
And we're talking about the Seven Sisters, the Leninist arts colleges, not other Seven Sisters. But okay, we'll take a chance. Robert, Villa Park. Hey, Robert.
Hey, how you doing? I believe it's Sneezy, Sleepy, Dopey, Grumpy.
I knew it.
The other ones I have a little trouble with.
Yeah. All right, very good. Thanks. The intellectual dwarfs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ralph and Rantoul. Hey, Ralph.
Ralph.
Oh, hey there. Sorry about that. I was asleep at the switch. You know, I don't remember all of the names of the sisters, but I do remember the movie they made about it, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. They all ended up marrying strapping young men with beards and plaid shirts, and they did a lot of singing and dancing.
Yeah, and they were victimized by the patriarchy. That's how that movie ended, as I recall.
And they were oppressed by love. They were victims of love, Dan and Amy.
All right, thanks for the call, Ralph. I don't think I'm going to get my answer. Dave and Niles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, great show as always. What you need to do these days, these children are so immature and so vulnerable, you've got to have them go to work for a year to 2 years before they go to college, between high school and college. That's the answer.
All right. Do you have any of the three remaining sisters that you want to mention?
Not offhand.
All right. Thanks for the call. I'm going to give you a hint. This is an easy one.
Right. What's the hardest?
If I give you the hint. All right. I'll give you a hint. One more. Hillary Clinton's alma mater.
Oh, that's, isn't it Wesley? Wasn't it?
That doesn't work on Jeopardy, but I'll give it to you. Wellesley.
Wellesley.
Yeah.
That's where she went, yes.
Okay. So
where did Rahm Emanuel go? No, I'm just kidding.
No, Sarah Lawrence, not one of the Seven Sisters.
I know.
Yeah.
Not all girls.
Although I'm sure he could have got into Vassar or Wellesley.
Barnard.
Alex in Hinsdale.
Hey, good morning, guys. We've hit a new level of ridiculousness with this, though, that Michelle Obama and Kamala Harris are repressed African-American females, and they've made it to the pinnacle of wealth and power, but they're repressed. They went to the most elite schools. At that point, and if they really believed what they're peddling as far as the global warming, that we have 12 years left before the seas rise. Why would the Obamas buy a $30 million mansion seafront on the East Coast?
Right. Yeah, very good. Thanks for the call, Alex. All right, I'll give you a hint on one of the remaining seven sisters.
Okay, what?
This sister includes among their famous graduates Eileen Ford, co-founder of Ford Models with her husband, John. Anybody? Bueller? And isn't that interesting? The founder of a modeling company, right? Women, because of their beauty.
Oh, my God.
Went to Barnard.
Sexually exploited.
Barnard.
Oh, Barnard.
Barnard is the answer. All right. Still two left, I believe. Andy Hinsdale.
I don't know any of the sisters, and I can go to my grave without knowing. But my question,
can you really? Can you really?
Yeah. No.
All right.
My question is, who even values these goofy colleges and their degrees anymore? I mean, unless it's a hard science, engineering, you know, architecture, something where you actually have to, you know, high-level math, what are these degrees even worth? I was in the Union League Club locker room a couple weeks ago, and I overheard two guys talking about, one guy was saying how his daughter was, she was on track to go to this I can't remember. It might have been your alma mater, Northwestern. Okay. I think it was for a journalism degree. And I wanted to go up to the guy and say, why do you hate your money so much that you just want to torch $250,000?
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? One of the things about the big recession that we're about to hit next year is that it really starts resetting values. And all these people with these worthless degrees are all going to be working at Starbucks if they can get a job there. And the people with valuable degrees are going to be working for companies. I mean, you're already seeing it.
Well, also, I mean, there was a piece over the weekend, I think it was in the Journal, talking about these big companies that are reducing the importance of the undergraduate degree and looking at the people to hire, even including for software engineers and so forth. I mean, we're talking about Google and IBM and, you know, big Fortune 500 companies, Fortune 100 companies. So, you know, that it's, I think it's slowly going in that direction, but it's definitely going in that direction where there is less emphasis being placed on these undergraduate degrees, even from quote unquote prestigious universities, because of exactly what you're saying.
Right. Because there's no value in them.
They see the actual work product from previous employees they've had from these colleges and like, what exactly are we paying for? Thanks for the call, Andy. All right, there's still
trivia.
Still two left.
Katharine Hepburn graduated from this college in 1928. Which one is it?
Well, is it?
It's one we haven't mentioned yet. Well, we might have though.
Well, if it has to be, the only one we haven't mentioned would be Bryn Mawr.
Bing.
Was one.
Got it.
Yeah, Bryn Mawr. And then this is the tough one.
All right, what do you got?
Well, should I tell? Should I wait? Should I tell?
Well, who's a famous alum? Who's?
You know, actually, I don't know a famous alum from this one. You know, okay. I only know so many famous alums from so many of the Seven Sisters. This is actually technically the eighth, but it's considered one of the Seven Sisters. Now, scholars disagree on this. All right, hold on a second. George and Niles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, I've got the answer.
Yeah.
The seven. Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Horst Buchholz, The Magnificent Seven.
Right, yes. The Seven Sisters. As the Seven Sisters, as the Magnificent Seven, were not known. Yes.
Oh,
right,
this Lasko is some very famous alum. Nancy Reagan, Barbara Bush.
And what's
Gloria
school is that?
Steinem.
Yeah, of course, Gloria Steinem.
Tammy Baldwin.
Right. Let's go lesbians. What school is that?
Julia Child.
Thanks for the call,
George. It is Smith.
I already mentioned Smith.
Oh,
nice try.
Darn.
No, those seven, are they seven? But they, I see Agnes Scott included in the Seven Sisters, to make it the eighth sister, the sister nobody talks about. Again, you know, Leninist arts collegiate scholars like myself disagree on this. It's a running debate. I'm sure you're interested in more detail. Deb and Lombard, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I love your show. Did anybody mention Bryn Mawr?
Yes.
Yes, we did.
Just called.
Radcliffe?
Bryn Mawr has been called. Radcliffe has been called.
Vassar?
Yep.
Vassar has been called. They've all been called now. Yeah.
Barnard?
Barnard's been called.
Okay. Well, our son's longtime ex-girlfriend went to Mount Holyoke on a, of course, you know, a low-income free ride. And we made John work, and he worked his way through college, and we gave him money, and he worked his way through law school. And she would always say, why do you have to act like, you know, you respect your parents, and why do you have to be so grateful to your parents? And we were like, oh, my gosh.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And did she have to get deprogrammed after she got out of Mount Holyoke?
No, she got deprogrammed after 6 years out of our lives.
Nice.
Yes.
Wow. So your son made a choice that said, I don't want to live like this for the rest of my life, I'm guessing.
Well, he was working his way, you know, Northwestern Law when we were all in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And she would lay on the sofa and watch TV in the apartment that we were paying for. And we were just like, don't you think it would help for you to get a job? You went to Mount Holyoke. And she just was like, why are you pushing me to work? I just don't understand that. We were just like, Lord help us.
but please tell me your son wised up and said, this can't go on?
Oh, after 6 years, he finally did. And he's engaged to a finance girl, and you can't squeeze a nickel between them. I mean, it's great.
That's awesome.
Okay.
Very, very good. Thanks for the call, Deb. Oh, we got a text from our program director. He listens to the show. For bonus points, what Greek myth does the Seven Sisters come from? I know this.
I'll let you answer that.
I know this. Wait, I got a mental block. John Cass is going to kill me for not knowing this. I can't think of it.
Oh no! Come on, you could do it.
All right, we're gonna let's take a break. I need two commercials to think about this, and then we'll come back.
P.
Oh, you just looked it up.
No, well, I had it up here.
thank God for Google. All right. Okay, Alex Trebek will be, or Ken Jennings now. Yeah. We'll be back with the final Jeopardy answer after this.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Former CIA analyst Bob Baer was on over the weekend on CNN talking about Elon Musk's amnesty for those previously banned on Twitter, and suggests that the free speech argument is nonsense, and that what Elon Musk is doing is essentially colluding with the Russians.
Well, Boris, I can tell you one thing. Putin is going to be all over Twitter. If there's no regulations on this, fake accounts, spoofed accounts, the rest of it, this is a great opportunity for him. And so when he's talking about the popular voice, Musk, he's really talking about Russian intelligence. You know, the Russians are waiting for something like this. They need a propaganda campaign against the United States and against our support for Ukraine. And they're going to be all over Twitter. I guarantee this. Supporting the far right plans, demands to stop arming Ukraine. You just wait. Well, that's why the pre-Musk Twitter had 7,000 people going through these accounts. You can pick them out with algorithms. You can pick them out by looking at them. You can check IPs and the rest of it, and you simply block them. And it's not right. And, you know, this freedom of speech is just nonsense, because you can't go into a movie theater and yell fire. It's against the law. What Putin's going to do, and the Russians, is they're going to use this as a vehicle to save himself in Ukraine. And, you know, whether it's going to work or not, I don't know. But we're going to see, as soon as these restrictions come off, we're going to see the Russians all over, as I just said.
You know what I'm struck by? And we've had Robert Baer on the show before when he had a book out. But the whole nature of some of these guys, Frank Figliuzzi, we talked about last week on the FBI side, former FBI agent, Bob Baer on the CIA side. You know what strikes me about them?
What?
Their complete lack of intellectual rigor. What is Bob Baer talking about? Elon Musk is reinstating people on Twitter who are actual people. They're not fake accounts. They're not Russian intelligence officers. They're not bots. They're actual people. Like, former President Trump is an actual human being. He's actually an actual former president. And if he wants to tweet, he'd be tweeting under his account. Or anyone else that's been, Project Veritas, anybody else that's been reinstated. So what are you talking about? That's number one. The analogy to fire in a crowded theater is completely disjointed. That holds no water. That makes no sense. There is no imminent threat posed by somebody with an actual account tweeting under their name. No imminent threat to unrest. And third, if I can, I mean, three red herrings in 90 seconds, pretty impressive by Bob Baer. The idea that, you know, a Russian bot account is going to move public opinion away from support for Ukraine against the Russian invasion that is overwhelmingly bipartisan nature, even as billions continue to flow to Ukraine. One Twitter account is going to do that. And by the way, I'm not even suggesting that Elon Musk, if he knew it, would not disable those fake accounts, because remember when he was pursuing the purchase of Twitter, he thought he was being misled in terms of how many fake accounts there are, and he wanted a real accounting of those. He's not a free speech absolutist. He just seems like he is because of people like Bob Baer and the other hysterics on cable news channels. This is just absurd. What are you talking about? The whole thing, it's whatever it was, $75,000 in fake Facebook ads over, you know, Russia overturned the will of the people in 2016 and installed Trump with their $75,000 Facebook campaign against the backdrop of, you know, a couple billion dollars that was spent between the two campaigns. I mean, these are unserious people in serious times. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Kevin Brock, former assistant FBI director for Counter Intel. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan, Amy, how are you? Good morning. And I'm sorry I dozed off during Mr. Bear's soundbite there.
I mean, honestly.
I've heard it so often.
Honestly. And you know, I don't know if you knew him when he was there. I think we talked about him before. But Frank Figliuzzi over on MSNBC spewing the same fact-free silliness.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right, and it goes, I think, even a little bit deeper than that, Dan, because if I could advise your listeners on how to listen to retired guys like me coming out of the FBI and draw some distinctions, I've done scores of interviews with cable news networks and radio shows like yourself. I've never been paid a dime. I mean, you haven't offered me a morning donut, Dan, and I don't take money, and I don't want it. And I do that on purpose. These guys have signed up as paid contributors for MSNBC and CNN. And once that happens, then they are now obligated to create controversial statements that will help sell airtime. And so they become mouthpieces for, in their case, the progressive left. And they are under pressure to continue to do that. They don't have a firm a stance or belief or any type of intellectual insight into these issues any more than Bob the bus driver does. You know, I try to stay in a lane of, all right, this is what the FBI can and can't do. This is what they messed up with. Here's some perspective on why they may have done this. These guys are now, like Frank Figliuzzi, opining on the motivations of a shooter at the Q Club in Denver. So that's a horrible situation. And projecting that they must be motivated by right-wing rhetoric, and therefore the subliminal message, and not so subliminal message in many cases, is we have to guard against that kind of rhetoric and we have to shut it down. And he indicts the Tucker Carlson show because the Tucker Carlson show is swamping NBC and CNN in the ratings. And so it's all a game. It's attached to money and revenue and clicks and driving business. And so I would caution anybody that's listening to some of these former retirees to look at what their role is. Are they paid contributors, and kind of view it through that lens?
But don't you agree it does tarnish the reputation of the FBI by him coming out and saying that, you know, Tucker Carlson should face civil consequences if the mass shooter consumes his hateful rhetoric?
It's horrible, Amy, because obviously from a legal standpoint, even from a civil proceeding standpoint, it would be very difficult to bring a case in that regard. And you would think a guy that spent 20-something years in the FBI would know better than to say something like that. But again, he's talking through his hat. He's just generating controversial statements because that's what they want him to do. No, it reflects poorly on the FBI. It's embarrassing to the rest of us. He has to live with the reputation that he has inside the FBI, and he knows what that is. And but, you know, when you're getting paid a lot of money, you'll do certain things.
I wanted to get to a more serious topic as well. Representative Mike Gallagher, who is a Marine Corps intel officer, is now a Republican from Wisconsin, Republican member of Congress, and Marco Rubio, of course, senator from Florida, have introduced legislation to ban TikTok in this country, calling it, Mike Gallagher calling it digital fentanyl. And I wonder what your view is on, I mean, even setting aside the question of whether that it's appropriate to ban a social media platform at all. Would that be effective in stopping the Chi-Coms from mining data on Americans?
Probably not. TikTok is one of several avenues that they use to gather that data. They've been doing so for years. I have said on numerous occasions that if the Internet weren't invented, China would still be a third world country. They have stolen all of their technology from us and other Western countries. They have built on the backbone of our research and development. They are a vacuum cleaner when it comes to scarfing up data and using it to their advantage. They passed a law in 2016 mandating that any Chinese citizen must provide information to the state of intelligence value. So any company that's based in China, any company that's doing business in China that has Chinese staff, all of those individuals will be reporting to the MSS and other Chinese intelligence services on stuff that they're gleaning from the data that they generate. All apps generate data. That's how revenue is built today. American companies do it. They're collecting data. In our country, we like to think that the government is not using that data. It's used for private marketing purposes. But it is there, and it is available. The door has been open. It is a reality of life. I think what people have to understand is when they download these apps, they should do so with their eyes wide open and understand that their data will be collected and exploited and used. Some people are comfortable with that, depending on generational values and the way they filter life. But, you know, that is a reality that we're dealing with right now, and it would be difficult for those on the right to argue, well, we need to shut down those platforms completely when they're arguing the opposite you know, when it comes to Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that well, I guess, one, do you think it's a good idea if you want to opine on that? But even if you thought it was a good idea, would it have residual benefit for Americans, for our national security interests?
Absolutely it would.
It would.
And I think that's why the Trump administration looked hard at TikTok and, you know, put in the limitations that they did put in. And from our standpoint, from a national security standpoint, that has to be considered legitimate and fair game.
It wouldn't be the end of the problem, but it would strike a blow against the Chinese communists and their advances, is what you're saying.
Try to slow them down a little bit, yeah, and just to educate people as to what this is really going on here. So, China has made clear what their goals are. The FBI director has made clear that they're the number one threat to our national security. They want to replace us as the world's dominant superpower, replace her as the reserve currency. They make no bones about it, and they're working diligently to do that. And they're disrupting us on all fronts. They're sending fentanyl in here, and all the chemicals that go into making fentanyl to destroy our middle class and rural middle class in this country, and they're doing a good job of it. And we don't see the type of alarm and action on the part of, you know, our current government to really react like that. It's very concerning.
And do you have any hopes that the protests going on against President Xi right now in China with respect to the COVID zero policies, that do you have any hopes that those go anywhere to destabilize that regime?
Historically, they haven't been able to do that. You know, going back to Tiananmen Square, that is a strong government. It's a strong centralized government, communist government, and they have a stranglehold on that country. The only thing I think more than COVID is if their economy really, really, really starts to tank, which could happen in a controlled economy, then there might be an uprising in sheer numbers that might affect change. But right now, I don't see it, Dan.
He is Kevin Brock, former assistant director of Intel for the FBI, former principal deputy director of the National Counterterrorism Center as well. Kevin Brock, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.